So tonight, I'm determined to finish this chapter 5, going through this, because partly because the weeks are rolling on, and also because this chapter on the 8 consciousnesses and this whole system, I feel like is really just the setup for the actual meditation that the sutra is going to present that comes in chapter 6 and 7. So this is really like this map or model of these consciousnesses is setting the stage. It's explaining the kind of like maybe kind of psychological background for the meditation. And it's an important part of the teachings, the classical teachings of this mind-only school, is this 8 consciousness system and the alaya, vijnana. So I think it's good that we include this chapter and have gone through this, I think, quite thoroughly. And I want to finish the chapter, so it's a little bit more, and then go on to the these next 2 chapters that I think are more, maybe a little less theoretical and more like how to apply it. At least that's the way I'm seeing it. Oh, also to start with Sally's question from the end of last week. I think I maybe afterwards remembered what you said you were speaking about, something about now. And tell me if this was the point. The calm abiding without support is the meditation practice that I was calling resting in nowness. Was it about meditation practice? So proposing that there's this a meditation practice of calm abiding means like tranquil sitting, stilling the mind, relaxing completely into the present moment, and called shamatha, which means calm abiding, and that there's shamatha with support means like using an object like the breath is like a as a meditation object, a support. And then there's calm abiding without support means without a meditation object per se. So that's like, if we describe that, we could say it's resting in nowness. So nowness is not exactly an object, a meditation object, but I think what I was saying at that time was that it kind of is still. Even nowness with no particular focus is still slightly conceptual. There's a slight concept of now, even though there might not be words behind it, but it's, or maybe a better way to say it is, it's slightly dualistic. That the conceptual and dualistic, you know, I was trying to make a distinction in past classes, and that could get really tricky, I think. So mainly the thing is that nowness is still it's a little bit like it's an external thing to the mind in a very, very slight way. in calm abiding practice. So then we have this other aspect of meditation besides the calm abiding. It's called insight. So shamatha and vipassana, these 2 sides of meditation, which chapter 8 of this sutra we won't get into, but if you have the sutra, it goes into very detailed exposition of shamatha and vipassana, calm abiding and insight. And so insight in the end is completely non-dual. That's what makes it different from mere calm abiding. the way the sutra talks about it is in its earlier stages, it's actually, it does seem actually conceptual. The sutra says it's that the calm abiding is non-conceptual and the vipassana is conceptual, almost like the reverse of what how I'm presenting this now. But in the end, when they're conjoined, is another way to say it, when the calm abiding and insight are conjoined, it's the non-dual, non-conceptual wisdom mind that realizes suchness, emptiness. So even the concept, very subtle concept of nowness doesn't exist because there's no time. The time is actually subtly conceptual. So that's kind of going back to, I don't remember exactly how that fit into the context, but is that what you were asking about?
I don't remember at this point, but I hear that.
Okay, so that's a little review about, I think it came up in the context of how all of these, even this mental consciousness is that's just aware of objects is dualistic by its nature. It's a divided knowing.
I think they said something like nowness is different from the moment. This moment. What is this moment? Or he was saying. Do you remember what he said?
I'm trying to hear what you just
said. I said this happened as a result of a conversation, and he said nowness is different from something you were saying, like the moment. Or do you remember what that word he said? Or this, the present, or.
I mean, this is 2 weeks ago now, so.
Yeah, it's really hard to recreate, but it was very interesting.
And we may get into this more as we get into the next chapter, which will continue with more meditation-oriented discussion, too. Is there anybody who doesn't have a chapter 5, a copy of this chapter 5? Even if you don't have it with you, you can listen along. So I think we left off on page 71. It's talking about these two types of appropriation or grasping, and it's called the basis consciousness, alaya vijnana. It's called mind. So that was the introduction to this storehouse consciousness. Do you remember that? This was actually 2 weeks ago now too. So it's all the things we talked about last week. So I don't think we yet got to this part of Vishalamati, the sixfold collection of consciousness, the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body, mind consciousness, arises depending upon and abiding in that appropriating consciousness. I think this is around where we left off in the sutra. But that probably makes sense to you at this point from our discussion about how all of these things are arise from and depend on the storehouse or basis consciousness, or also called the appropriating consciousness. That all seven basically come out of eight and go back into eight, like seeds being planted and then sprouting. An eye consciousness arises depending on an eye and a form in association with consciousness. So it's a little ambiguous here, but the way that I interpret and other people seem to interpret consciousness at the end of the sentence there is referring to the appropriating consciousness, the storehouse. So that an eye consciousness, how does an eye consciousness arise? It depends on the eye, the organ, the gate, right, and the object, the color, along with the storehouse consciousness. So it's just one way of talking about this. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The I consciousness depends on these three different things come together. In a way, you could say the early model would just say it just arises. The I consciousness arises dependent on the I and the color, but in this case, they're saying it also dependent on the eighth consciousness, because that's what it's all coming out of. That's the little twist in this sutra, which is maybe why Buddha says it here. Functioning together with that I consciousness, a conceptual mental consciousness, this is the sixth consciousness, arises at the same time, having the same objective reference. Meaning, like, there's a direct, we talked about this last week too, there's a direct visual perception of a color, and then at the same time, with the same object, there's a mental consciousness that then can name it yellow and can know it as a in a conceptual way. Right? So this is a nice little summary of how this works. Does that make sense to people? Mm-hmm. Right, that there's a...
So then that includes number six.
Right, that's number six. The conceptual mental consciousness is number six. At the same time, and maybe different schools of Buddhism would debate whether it's the same time or a moment later, but this sutra says the same time with the same object.
Mm-hmm. So that's the question I had, the same time thing. Mm-hmm. Because when I hear that, I think about the skandhas where first there's form, mm-hmm. and then actually mm-hmm. there's feeling before there's the perception and impulse. And I'm wondering if I'm just making that up, or if that's a different
yeah.
story of what they're saying.
Well, my understanding of the skandhas is that they are taught in a specific order, like you're saying, but it's not necessarily that they're chronological they're sequential.
Hmm.
They often say they're all operating at the same time. It's not like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Especially that comes in if we have the mental consciousness, the fifth skanda, which is the same as the sixth consciousness here,
mm-hmm.
is aware of the whole process from the beginning. It's aware of feelings, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we can tell a story of the skandhas going in the order that they're usually taught, but I think it's sometimes presented as, it's not necessarily chronological.
And this sutra is saying it's all the same.
And this sutra is emphasizing the same time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So at the same time, the eighth consciousness is...
Eighth is always operating. Yeah, eighth is uninterrupted. It's sometimes called the, like a river, like always uninterrupted, even through sleep.
So it's always coterminous, even if there isn't an object that you see, like as you're sleeping.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the only one that continuous doesn't mean like it's a permanent entity, which is why, as we'll see at the end of the chapter, the Buddha says this alaya thing is really tricky, because when we say continuous, unceasing flow, it starts to sound like a self, and so he says it's not, and yet it's the continuity or the continuum of the moment to moment, arising and ceasing, continuum of the storehouse consciousness continues through sleep and formless samadhis and fainting and these other kind of unconscious states.
And it's always changing, right?
It's always changing, yeah.
With each
yeah, sense, it's continuously, yeah. Yeah, and it's not even like an it, really. I mean, we're just to talk about it, we call it this, and we have these images like storehouse and collection of seeds and so on. But all these are just metaphors. It's completely ungraspable, constantly changing, unceasing continuum that we think of as the self, actually. It's all our karmic tendencies, which are constantly changing and evolving in all kinds of ways. But that's one of the main reasons that it was taught, as I understand, why the Buddha put forth the teaching of the storehouse consciousness, was that, how can we stay alive when we're asleep if all the other six are not operating? Also, we're talking about deep dreamless sleep, because, as I understand it, in a sleeping dream, the sixth consciousness is actually operating. The five senses are shut down, but the sixth is conjuring up its own mental world, similar to this one. Yes. Yeah, they have a sense of identity. That's a good point. It's the moment we wake up in the morning,
yeah,
we remember who we are.
There was one time when I was traveling and I was so tired, I had fallen asleep, and when I woke up, I couldn't remember who I was. I started repeating to myself, I'm on my way somewhere, I'm traveling, until it came in. You know, I didn't have gender or name or anything.
That's great.
I think it was for probably about 90 seconds. maybe 2 minutes. I was just like, I'm on my way somewhere.
I think traveling is good in that way, because you wake up in a room and it's like, this is not, you know, in our usual room,
yeah,
it's harder to get into those not knowing mind, but like, if you're traveling constantly in a different hotel room or something, it's like, where am I? I even like know I'm traveling, but like, I might even know what country I'm in, but like, I don't know what province or whatever. It takes a while. And I think those are great moments, because they're like, it's like forgetting the self in a way and trying to get a hold of it. Usually it's quite uncomfortable to not know who we are, especially for 90 seconds.
Yeah. The last couple of weeks I've looked at eight is kind of, you know, the storehouse sense, the causes and the condition that would give rise to personhood, but that the sense of self is in seven.
Yeah, the sense of self is in seven. But actually,
the sense of being present might be in eight, but the sense of self would be in seven.
Another way it's often talked about is that the sense of self that actually is seven in a way, the afflicted mind organ, mind faculty, is, we could call, the sense of self. But the way it makes the sense of self is it interprets Alaya to be the self. So in that way it's related. The actual clinging to the view, we could say, is in number seven, but the material that it's clinging to create the view of a self, is eight.
So eight is like possibilities and potentialities and probabilities, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it gets actualized through the actual presence of the activation of all these other consciousnesses.
Yep.
But then we solidify it and differentiate it through this afflicted mind.
Yeah, and the afflicted mind, the self thing is all connected with as soon as there's a self, there's other, or there's objects,
right.
There's self and
also,
objects.
It also defines others.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, in fact, it's like undifferentiated stuff, and the seventh is what makes it, splits it into the, like a real, eye and a color as separate. The sense that they're separate is congealed and solidified.
That's your quantum consciousness right there. Eight.
Maybe, I don't know so much about quantum, but
well, you better get ready.
Okay. Yeah.
Number seven, could it be thought of as like a collection of labels waiting to be imputed?
Collection of labels waiting to be imputed.
Or even in the process of being imputed.
Yeah, because I don't, like waiting, if we're talking about waiting.
Not just waiting, but.
Actually being imputed. Yeah.
Because
I think, in a way, any idea of like a bag or a collection waiting is more like the eighth, is storing the stuff. Because
not just waiting.
But actually the labeling itself,
yeah.
You're saying? Yeah. Sometimes, though, the sixth consciousness I've heard talked about as the one that ascribes names and labels, interestingly. Because sometimes it's talked about more as like it's just this immediate, especially like a direct mental perception. It's an immediate awareness, but it also can have this kind of grosser form of ascribing names. But the way that names get connected with objects, and then it's like fused with objects, and believed that like this is the floor. That thing, that part, when we connect a name with the object, in chapter 6 we'll say it in almost this exact way. It talks about names connected with signs. That is, the job of the seventh. So it's more like the names themselves maybe immediately can arise up with the six, but the seventh is what like solidifies the name into being an object. Like this is a book. And feeling like this really is a book. Book is just this name, right? But we feel like it's a book. So the way that the name is connected with this, with the signs of an object, and they seem to be fused together, the name and the object, that is the job of Manas, the seventh.
So the seventh actually defines the relationship to the thing's name.
They're very similar. Yeah, it is difficult to separate the two, and I think chapter 6 will help more. You could almost say also that the seventh is just a greater solidification and dualification of the six. The six is already subtly dualistic and conceptual, and the seventh makes it really that way. So, they're similar, actually, yeah.
It'd be something like, say, through one of the other five senses, and the sixth identifies that. Say that eye sees red.
Mm-hmm.
So, the sixth would say red, and maybe seventh would apply some sort of value.
The seventh is mainly about
assessing the red or whatever.
Even more than assessing, it's like making it it's in its relationship to me.
I see red
and you might not even have those words, but like there's red and it's out there apart from me and this mind, and it really is red.
You know, red is a danger to me, or it's not a danger to me, or that.
Yeah, well, you could say all our reactions to it are based on that. But the seventh, maybe this helps to know a little bit about the seventh, to say that, how does Vasubandhu say it? He's like, it's the sense of a self, but it's like it's relational. So associated with Alaya, the storehouse, and the process and churning of Alaya, and depending upon it occurs the consciousness called Manas, which is of the nature of mentation, thinking, endowed with the four types of defilements, constantly concealed and undefined, like we can't get a hold of these. The seventh we're talking about now. The four types of defilements are self-view, self-confusion, self-esteem, and self-love. Self-love. So it's that's why it's kind of the sense of a self that comes along with these four self qualities. self-view, just that, like, I am me, you know. And self-confusion means, like, but what am I? I know I am, but, like, I can't pinpoint it, I can't get a hold of it, and, like, what am I actually? I'm me! Like, all that confusion arising from the view, right? Self-esteem, you know, like, and I'm the best. And self-love means, like, and I'm the most important. So, these kind of things.
Self-confusion would be like an inability to understand the relationship. At that moment, you haven't heard enough of God.
In a way, we're always somewhat confused. We feel, especially in a class like this, but maybe all the time, we're always a little bit confused about who we are. And we try to prevent ourselves from feeling that way, but the proposal, as long as there's a view of a self, it's going to be a confusing situation, a confusing life, because the self isn't really, that we have this view of, isn't really there. So it's naturally, things are never going to work out, and we're never going to actually figure out who we are, because there's nobody there. So it's, oh, and if we try to, like, I'm over here, or like, I'm in this skanda, and then, like, no, but then that slips away. Then I'm over here, and, like, so that might be part of the confusion, trying to get a hold of who we are, or, like, these 90 seconds as we wake up in a foreign country or something. And it's like there's this confusion. And then when we do feel comfortable and not confused, it's just like we're loosely holding things together, you know, temporarily. We're like, okay, we've got it together enough to get through the day now. But actually, if we look more closely and carefully and, like, and in a concentrated way, the confusion will be there.
So when we cultivate seven, which is not to say letting it drop off, but the opposite of that, we wind up ultimately with...
What was the first part of the sentence?
When we cultivate seven, which is different from letting it drop off.
Okay.
Actually in there, using yeah. it.
Which we can't help cultivating.
Yeah. We wind up ultimately when we have this extension of this process to say, this is my world.
Yeah. Yep.
My reality. I don't
yep.
want to go to war with you because yep. you agree with it.
Yep. And what we call my world is all in here. Okay. So all these different angles, you know, we're just, hopefully this is becoming more and more clear, because I think it's an unusual system, but I think these discussions are helpful in clarifying how this works. Okay, so now we have this, back to the sutra, we have the conceptual mental consciousness at the same time with the same objective reference. Vishalamati, an ear consciousness, nose, tongue, and body consciousness arise depending on ear, nose, tongue, body in association with consciousness and sound, smell, taste, tangibles. So same thing with all five senses. Functioning together with nose, ear, tongue, and body consciousness, a conceptual mental consciousness arises at the same time with the same reference. So just repeating. If there arises one consciousness, there arises together with it only one mental consciousness. One eye consciousness or any sense consciousness. There is only one mental consciousness with the same object as the eye consciousness. Likewise, if 2, 3, 4, 5 sense consciousnesses arise together, there still arises together with them only one conceptual mental consciousness, which has the same object of activity as the fivefold collection of consciousness.
So that's six.
Six. Mm-hmm. So this is just a nice story that this is telling too, is when we're right now, we're seeing and hearing and we're feeling our butt on the floor or whatever, so there's multiple sense consciousnesses operating, but it's saying there's only one six mental consciousness. But so it's just kind of fleshing out the system a little bit more.
So basically, when you read a concert and there's a violinist playing a violin, and there's sights, sounds, all
yep.
these things happening, it is one violinist playing a violin. It's not like the violinist that has long hair, the violinist that's coughing, the violin that is being held, the violin that is being making sound. It's just one experience, no matter how many of these different things are being involved.
Yeah, there's one experience. Yeah, it's a nice way to put that. There's six mental. There's only one. Six mental conceptual consciousness means there's like we're only having one experience, and it's amazing that it can do that, isn't it? That the six consciousness can like put all these different sensory things together and call it a one experience.
It's the aggregator.
And actually, isn't that true in our experience? That isn't it so? Doesn't it seem that this is just one experience? Okay, so. So if there arises one consciousness, there's only one mental consciousness. Likewise, at 2, 3, or 4, or 5, there's still only one conceptual mental consciousness. Now, they kind of, it seems like the Buddha's kind of switching. He's going to come up with this metaphor now, but... it seems to be that he's talking about switching back to the storehouse image. Because he says, Vishalamati, for example, if the causal conditions for the arising of one wave in a great flowing river are present, then just one wave will arise. If the causal conditions for two waves or more waves are present, then multiple waves will arise, but the river's own continuity will not be broken. It will never be entirely stopped.
Couldn't that also be talking about the six consciousness that you just said? Like, we perceive reality as kind of this...
Yeah, it does say that. It does seem like you could interpret it that way. But then, later, it seems that... it seems to be implying alaya. Let's keep going. Mm-hmm. So now, now we're going to have another metaphor for the same thing. If the causal conditions for the arising of a single image in a perfectly clear round mirror are present, then just one image will arise. If the causal conditions for the arising of two images or many images are present, then multiple images will arise. However, that round mirror will not be transformed into the nature of the image. They will never be fully linked. Vishalamati, just as it is with water and the mirror, if depending upon and abiding in the appropriating consciousness, so here's where it seems to be now, we're back to the appropriating. The causal conditions for the simultaneous arising of one eye consciousness are present, then one eye consciousness will arise, and up to the fivefold will arise. So that seems, from that point, it seems to be then bringing it back to the appropriating or alaya consciousness. But could it be the same? Could it be the six in the mirror image too? And the mirror metaphor? Maybe. Maybe that there's this reflection. There's only one reflection happening, conceptual reflection happening, no matter what kind of different senses are reflected in there. Yes, Jean.
It's a little ambiguous in the phrase, they will never be fully linked.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Because in the case of mirror, mirror isn't functioning as a mirror unless there's an image.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a piece of glass that has silver on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is true that an image isn't an image unless it's perceived.
Yes.
So they are linked because each defines the other. Each is not the other, and I think that's what that phrase means, but they are linked.
Yeah, maybe linked is not the best translation, because actually it seems what it's trying to imply is that they're not the same, they don't become each other, but linked in terms of interdependent, I think so, yeah. They are dependent. Dependently co-arise.
The prior phrase that round mirror will not be transformed into the nature of the image is accurate.
Yeah. So I think you're right about the fully linked, and if we look at the other translations, they don't say that. One says, these are from the Chinese, one says, The mirror surface does not alter itself into the image and suffers no change at all. And the other one says, the surface of the mirror does not change into images and no end to its function can be found. So, yeah, so that's a good point. I think that the link means that when we're maybe what it's pointing towards is the teaching that the conceptual you know, grasping of this as yellow will never be the same as the direct perception of yellow. That's how I take it. One way I could take it.
It will never be the same.
The same, like, as the object itself.
Yeah.
Like our conceptual thinking will never be able to actually get at the object itself, the directly perceived object.
So that brings back the question I think that prompted Sally's question: is where isness is the where in this model does the possibility for direct expression or direct experience occur?
Yeah. So I can't remember if we talked about last time. There's the terms direct perception, which all sensory experience is direct perception, and it's consciousness. So this is where we get into this problem. It seems that direct sensory perception, it's non-conceptual, but it's subtly, very, very subtly, in a way we can't see, subtly dualistic, which seems to be confirmed by the fact that the sense consciousnesses are called vijñanas. They're called divided knowings. And at Buddhahood, they're transformed into non-dual jnana, where they're no longer divided. So that's a little clue that even the sense consciousnesses at Buddhahood are no longer sense consciousnesses. To be completely non-dual, they're transformed or revealed as completely non-dual. So even in direct, non-conceptual, direct perception is still subtly dualistic in the sense that there's this very slight unconscious sense of it's not all just mind, that there's an external world, which is why naturally in our more everyday thinking mind, we strongly resist this idea that there may be no external world. Because even at the direct perceptual level, according to this school, there's this very slight grasping of an external world. Let me just finish this part of the story about then the mental consciousness can also have direct perception, like immediately. Well, according to this, it sounds like at the same time as the direct sensory perception, and then it can also transform into a grosser conceptual form. We could say there's two kinds of mental consciousness: a direct perception, direct mental perception, and then the more common everyday consciousness, which is called indirect perception, or in other words, conception. Conceptual consciousness, which is conceptual and dualistic. So then the question: where is there room for where does direct experience come in? We could say we could have a direct mental perception, and maybe this goes back to this question too about nowness, that. In calm abiding meditation, we can get very, very still and be resting in nowness in a way that that gross mental conceptual activity is very, very stilled. There's like maybe there's a moment or two where there's no thoughts arising at all, And we might call that a direct mental perception of nowness or something. But as I understand the school, which goes very deep into these different aspects of mind, that even though we could call it a direct perception, it's still not non-dual realization. Maybe that's the distinction. That for complete non-dual realization, there is actually no external world, according to the school. And there's a non-dual realization of that. So this is like, you know, to try to get a hold of what this is even talking about is hard to put into words, to say the least. But when we finish this part of the chapter, I want to read this section of Kazan talking about this, because I think it might help clarify this also. At least it's a version, that, a Zen version of playing with these questions about meditation. And we can see if it seems to agree with the sutra or not. So let's come back to that point. Rich, did you?
I was just wondering if the number six, dualistic awareness, cognition, discernment, if it was tainted from direct perception because of an effect of the karmic seeds in Alaya.
All distortions come from seeds in Alaya.
So then if karmic seeds were somehow erased,
they're come to fruition. In the seed example, it's more like all the seeds for dualistic conception of the world and dualistic perception, even all you know, they have to, they can't, we can't get rid of them. They have to come to fruition. But then the idea with the seed metaphor is, no more, at some point after the path of seeing, we're not planting any more dualistic seeds. So eventually all the seeds sprout, but no more are planted. So this field becomes like there's nothing left in it. And when there's completely nothing left in it, that's when it's, in a way, sometimes they say transform, but I think better to call it like nothing happens there. It's just that at that time it is the perfect mirror, non-dual realization.
So there would be no way of tainting the direct perception in creating this dualistic awareness anymore because of the fruition of all its seeds. So it all kind of explains how direct perception becomes all that's left, because the indirect perception is only created by the tainting.
And even direct perception of that happens with consciousness. It's not like at the end you're left with mental consciousness, because all eight consciousnesses are transformed into non-dual knowledge, gnosis, jnana. All eight, the five sense consciousnesses are transformed into this non-dual knowing too. Which is, this is where the story gets really far out, and in terms of our practice. It's, I think, good to know about, it's good to know how the system is presented traditionally, but it's so far out at that point. It's like, how to imagine this. And yet, at least the way when I read the descriptions of the traditional take on this, it seems like, wow, this is like amazing what's possible, but like, could we actually realize that? And that then in Zen, which is this wonderful creative approach to these, you know, it takes these sutras that seem like something so far away and it brings them right down to earth. There are like, you know, whether they're accurate according to the tradition or not is we could talk about, but like Hakuin Zenji has an essay on the eight consciousnesses that he talks about, like, oh, it can happen. I mean, it's definitely a practice to make it happen, but it's not like you have to be an eighth stage bodhisattva. And Shodo Harada Roshi, the Rinzai teacher who's still alive and teaching, and many Americans practice with him, he sometimes comes to the States. He a few years ago he was in the States, and he gave a talk on the eight consciousnesses, but in a kind of Zen style. It's like a little bit outside the classical way, and talked about how they transform into these five wisdoms, and then but it was more like it was this a little bit like this. It's this process of how all this happens, and then afterwards I went up and asked him. It's like, well, do you are these realized in a particular order? Is this a process of step by step process of transforming consciousnesses into wisdoms? And he said, well, actually, the part that I remember in particular was that he said the perfect mirror wisdom, which is the transformed alaya vijnana, he said, that's operating all the time for everybody. Whoa! This is like not what the classical tradition usually talks about it. But Zen is this wonderful non-dual emphasis tradition.
So achieving Buddha, I've used the word Buddha before, does not mean we're going off in a 2001 space odyssey and we no longer exist in this dimension. It just simply means we're able to do this without suffering. We're able to experience everything in the usual way, except we don't have all this clinging and differentiation and sense of self, but we have immediate experience. So, a Buddha can walk among us.
I think it's good to not make Buddha too big or too small. You know, I think sometimes like Asanga and Vasubandhu, the founders of the tradition in the 4th century, make Buddha seem very big, very like almost just like a theoretical possibility, and then some of the Zen teachers bring it really down to earth. But I think we can go too far in either direction, and I think so. I'll bring up Keizan, who I think that, when we get through this chapter, if we can make it through, let me read what Keizan says, because I think he presents a pretty big Buddha. But in a maybe more accessible way than, it's not about lots of stages anyway, the way he talks about it, but it's like pretty profound. It's the commentary on what dropping off body and mind means, according to Dogen, according to Keizan.
So I'm just curious, when did Gautama get this? Was he still walking around after he got it, or did he get it after Parinibbana? This is the point, by the way. You know, he got the mushroom and he died.
Did he see
Buddha before that, based on his experience? Did he achieve liberation from all this?
The story is that all this happened under the Bodhi tree.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the classical story. And then he looked like a person walking around. And there's three bodies of Buddha, which actually this school, the Yogacara, gets into. There's a relationship between these five wisdoms and the three bodies of Buddha. In other words, there's a Dharmakaya that's like so rarefied that it doesn't take any form at all, but it's a non-dual wisdom mind. But it has total potential, so it can manifest as a Nirmanakaya, like what looks like a human person walking on the earth. And it can also manifest as these Sambhogakaya, that's only apparent to certain bodhisattvas and basically creates these pure lands that are like great, have great zendos to practice in. Just as it is with the water and the mirror, depending upon and abiding in the appropriating consciousness, the causal conditions for the simultaneous arising, one consciousness arise, and so on. And five consciousnesses can arise with one mental consciousness. So, however, after the Buddha lays out this whole thing, When the Tathagata designates bodhisattvas as being wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness, it is not only because of this that he designates those bodhisattvas as being wise in all ways. Meaning, like, once one understands this whole system of eight consciousnesses and how these work, that's not all of wisdom. Now we get the radical Mahayana pep talk. Vishalamati, those bodhisattvas wise in all ways, do not perceive their own internal appropriators, their own graspers. They also do not perceive an appropriating consciousness, but they are in accord with reality. They also do not perceive a basis, nor a basis consciousness, do not perceive accumulations, karmic accumulations, nor do they perceive mind. They do not perceive an eye, a form, or an eye consciousness, an ear, sound, an ear consciousness. They don't perceive nose, smell, nose consciousness, tongue, taste, tongue consciousness, body, object, body consciousness. They don't perceive their own particular thoughts. Nor do they perceive phenomena, nor do they perceive a mental consciousness, but they are in accord with reality. So they don't perceive any of this. And does this long litany sound remind anyone of anything else? The Heart Sutra, yeah, sounds very much like this. It's a kind of nice twist. It's a kind of mind-only school twist on the Heart Sutra, because instead of just saying, I think same meaning, actually. It's the same meaning as the Heart Sutra, but instead of saying no eyes, no ears, no nose, it says they don't perceive an eye, an ear, nose. Same meaning, but because this school is all about perception and how we know things, it's saying that's what no eye actually means in the Heart Sutra, is that we don't perceive an eye. And perceive here, I think we can take to mean perceive as something external to mind, perceive in any kind of dualistic way. You know, because conventionally speaking, we could say they do perceive, you know, we perceive colors, but wise and always means actually we don't perceive colors. It's like the ultimate. It's like the first part of the chapter up to that point was the conventional description of how mind works, and now it's like, but wait, before we finish the chapter, bodhisattvas wise in all ways, also like none of this is happening. And the mind, and that's where we could say, when all these consciousnesses are transformed into this non-dual wisdom mind, that's when this would be the description of it. None of this stuff is perceived, and yet everything is possible. It's obviously inconceivable how that is so. Vishalamati, this is how bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness. When the Tathagata designates bodhisattvas as being wise with respect to secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness, he designates them as such for this very reason. Then the Bhagavan spoke this verse. If the appropriating consciousness, deep and subtle, all its seeds flowing like a river, were conceived as a self, this would not be right. Thus, I have not taught this to children. Or the other translations say, I have not revealed it to the foolish or the ignorant. And doesn't it, even in our discussions, isn't it so easy to start like attributing some substantiality to this like basis of all, this storehouse of all our karmic tendencies, and say like, that's who I am. And as I mentioned before, all schools of Buddhism have a ultimate view of the self, of the person, of the me, of the I, and a conventional view. And so ultimately there is no me, no I, but conventionally in the school, the conventional self is actually alaya. It means like that's what we think of as the self, and we like it even proposes that that's our innate view of who we actually think we are on the deepest level. When we investigate according to this school, we we conclude something like this Alaya, even before we have the name for it and all the description that we've just been doing about it, we think it's this collection of all our stuff. And before the schools that didn't have the storehouse consciousness, the conventional view of the self would be like the collection of five skandhas. So let me just bring up, I'm glad we finished that chapter, the Kazan's description here. And, you know, it's like this Yogacara thing, it's like it's a self-contained system, so it all makes sense within it. And if you go outside the system and start getting creative, like Zen people do, it's, you know, it might not match up exactly. But I think it's interesting what he does here. What's that?
In itself, it's just a theoretical concept.
All this is mere concept, yeah. So this is the transmission of light, the Denko Roku, and it's the section on, which is the stories of the awakening stories of all the Soto Zen ancestors up to Ejo, Dogen's disciple. So this is the section on Dogen, and it's arranged as, you know, koan stories of each of, from the records. And Dogen's is the story about dropping off body and mind, was Dogen's awakening. When he heard that phrase, drop off body and mind dropped off. So now he's like, Kazan's unpacking what this means. People think that their Kazan is the collector of these and commentator on these stories a couple of generations after Dogen in the 1300s. People think there are two kinds of mind. One is mind as thought and discrimination, and this consciousness which discriminates external events. I think he's referring to the sixth consciousness. The second is mind that is still and unmoving and does not know or understand a thing, the mind of purity and stillness. Now, we're going to see that he's actually referring to Alaya at this point. People do not understand such a mind, this still unmoving, not understanding mind, is still not exempt from being the root of discriminating consciousness. It's the root, right, because it gives rise to the sixth consciousness. The ancients referred to it as the place of deep inner brightness that is unmoved. Do not mistake this for mind, with a capital M, and abide there. And maybe the mind... I think what he's talking about, capital M mind... Now this is a Zen thing. This would be like the mind of no abode, or the Buddha mind. Let's say Buddha mind. Looking more carefully, mind, small m in quotes. It's hard, you know, because he's... but actually, this is the mind. We can correlate it with the sutra. This is this, you know, mind, intellect, and consciousness, as the sutra says. And it's referring to citta or alaya. Well, actually, looking more carefully, mind, in quotes, is of three kinds: mind, thought, and consciousness. So that's now he's getting into this Yogacara model. My overall mind is composed of the mind, thought, and consciousness, the citta, the you know, manovijnana, and the manas. The Chinese title for this chapter 5 that we just read is called The Characteristics of Mind, Thought, and Consciousness, which is the same characters he's using here. Consciousness, the sixth consciousness, is mind which likes and dislikes, affirms and denies. So I think this is kind of goes back to Daryl's question a little bit too, and I think this is how the school really defines it, is the sixth consciousness actually can affirm and deny, like and dislike. Thought, which is the seventh here, cognizes warm and cold and is aware of pain or tickle. So it's like the one that's aware. Now again, these two sound very similar, so I think let's not even get into saying what he's doing. And he's, since he's Zen, he can be a little rough with this. Mind, now we're talking about Alaya. Mind, Alaya, does not discern right and wrong, nor is it aware of pain or tickle. It's like a wall or like wood or stone. It can be thought of as truly still, as if it had no eyes or ears. And just to confirm what Vasubandhu says in the old days, he says, this Alaya is unidentified in terms of concepts of object and location. And it has a neutral feeling that's uninterrupted and undefined. And so it's we can't get a hold of it, in other words. Yet it's the source of everything else. So Alaya does not discern right and wrong, nor is it aware of pain or tickle. It's like a wall or like wood or stone. It can be thought of as truly still, as if it had no eyes or ears. Therefore, speaking from the vantage point of mind, it's like a mannequin made of wood or a human figure made of iron. Though you have eyes, you do not see. Though you have ears, you do not hear. At this point, words do not do it justice. Although such a thing is mind, it is the seed of cognition, of warmth, coldness, and awareness of pain and tickle. Thought and consciousness arise from it. Do not make the mistake of thinking that it is fundamental mind, like Buddha mind, original mind. So, without knowing this system, this might be a really strange thing to hear, because it sounds like, well, that sounds so great. Doesn't that sound like the mind of Zazen, like a wall, like stone? It doesn't hear or see or anything. It's totally still and bright even. And he's saying, don't mistake this for either for self or for like original mind, like Zen mind. Learning the way is said to be apart from mind, thought, and consciousness. And actually, in Dogen's Fugan Zazengi, it literally says, in his meditation instructions, he says, give up the operations of mind, thought, and consciousness. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. I think our current translation says, give up the... Give up all operations of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thought and views. Give up, you can see, I think it's give up the operations of the conscious mind, which is an abbreviation. What the Fugan Zazengi actually says is give up the operations of the sixth, seventh, and eighth consciousness, interestingly. Which is kind of sad that this translation doesn't bring that out. So learning the way is said to be apart from mind, thought, and consciousness. These must not be thought of as body and mind. There is still a wonderful brightness that is eternally unmoving. So now he's proposing another mind here. There is still, apart from mind, thought, and consciousness, there is a wonderful brightness that is eternally unmoving. If you look carefully, you will certainly reach it. If you are able to clarify this mind, capital M, no body and mind can be found. No self and others can be involved. Therefore, it is said, drop off body and mind. So, drop off, we could say, drop off these three minds, and then this wonderful brightness still remains, maybe the sutra, if we had to say it in terms of the tradition, we could say it's the great perfect mirror, non-dual wisdom. At this point, if you look intensely, even with 1,000 eyes, there's not an atom of anything called skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. In other words, there is not an atom of what we call a body. Right? There is no external world that we, like a material world that we call a body. Nothing to be discriminated as mind, thought, or consciousness. So, which is like a little commentary, you could say, on the last part of the sutra where they don't perceive a body and all these sense objects and they don't perceive mind and consciousness. It's the same as saying, there's not an atom of anything called skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Nothing to be discriminated as mind, thought, or consciousness. How can you then be aware of warmth and cold or discern pain and tickle? What is there to affirm or deny? What is there to like or dislike? Therefore, it is said, when you look, nothing is there. When Dogen personally experienced the place, he said, body and mind are dropped off. And Rujing confirmed this, saying, body and mind have dropped off, the dropped off body and mind. Finally, he said, the dropping off has dropped off. Once you reach this realm, you become like a bottomless bucket, like a lacquer bowl with a hole punched in it. No matter how much leaks out, it's never empty. No matter how much is put into it, it's never full. Arriving at this occasion is called the bottom falling out of the bucket. If you think that there's a hair of enlightenment or acquisition here, it's not the way. It's nothing but toying with the spirit. Experience it thoroughly with yourselves. Investigate it fully, and you will find that there is a body unbound by skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Though you ultimately try to liberate this body, liberation is not possible. Though you try to abandon it, you cannot. This is like the indestructible Buddha body. Therefore, in speaking of this place, the ancestral teachers say, when everything is utterly emptied out, there is something that cannot be emptied. If you can clarify this thoroughly, you'll never doubt all those venerable ones in the world or the Buddhas of past, present, and future. What is this principle? Would you like to hear it? He has a verse at the end of each chapter. That bright and shining realm has neither inside nor outside. How can there be any body and mind to drop off? Which is a wonderful mind-only verse. Ninth level of shamatha? Well, the ninth level of shamatha is very, very still and unmoving. It's true. But then when they make the distinction between shamatha and vipassana, it's still, it doesn't have the wisdom, the realization, the insight. And even going back to the early sutras, Buddha, before he went to the Bodhi tree, right? There were these teachers in India teaching very refined meditation states of stillness and tranquility, kind of like shamatha practice, but they call the jhanas. I think the jhanas and shamatha are very similar. And Buddha learned them easily. He had these great faculties for learning those meditations, and up to the eighth jhana, the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, right? Sounds pretty good, but he could practice that. He could rest in neither perception nor non-perception and the realm of nothingness. And these are some of the names for these jhanas. And that before he was Buddha, right, he learned these. And there were other people practicing them. And then the conditions for that state would wear off, and he'd get up and he'd be like, but still my fundamental issue is not resolved. That was like the most delightful experience I've ever had in my life, but I haven't found the deathless. I I haven't resolved this issue of the root of discontent, because now I'm not in that state and I want to be in it again, and therefore I'm discontent. And so he's like, and the teachers there said, wow, you realize this so quickly. Will you teach with me? And the Buddha's like, no, I'm not finished yet. So then he kept going, right? And then finally he's like, no, there's no teacher on earth that has gone beyond this neither perception nor non-perception jhana. He's like, I have to do this myself. And that's when he sat under the tree. And due to infinite eons of good karma that were generated, he realized the way that was, and if we talk about that in terms of the story, it's, he maybe reached the ninth level of shamatha and the eighth jhana both, and then but then conjoined them by actually using the investigative mind to actually like realize.
Ninth level, isn't that like it morphs into the beginnings?
It doesn't really morph. You still need to do this other step called vipassana.
Yeah, I'm kind of referring to a book by B. Allen Wallace, The Attention Revolution.
Yeah, so he's just emphasizing the shamatha side.
Yeah, but when he's talking about the ninth stage, that's where I got that phrase. I've asked the question one time of even memory ceases, because memory would make a reference to something dualistic. Without memory, then you can be alone. But if you think of something memory, it's fast.
Mm-hmm.
So that's dualistic. But that's where I got that expression. That expression.
Yeah, I mean, there are these, the Tibetan tradition, well, coming from India, has these nine levels of shamatha, and which are wonderful realms. And when you read the descriptions, again, it seems like, well, that sounds almost impossible to practice. And I've actually heard that Alan Wallace has these shamatha retreats, right? He's like, really, like, let's really explore the shamatha realm, even though we know it doesn't include vipassana. And so they have like a year-long, even though it doesn't include vipassana, he's like, he's like doing these experiments with shamatha, and he gets people to come for like a whole year of silent retreat just working on shamatha. And the story I've heard is that nobody got, in that year, that's all they were doing, nobody got past the fifth level of shamatha. So do we really need to do that? You know, I sometimes wonder. And the Zen tradition doesn't emphasize these levels of shamatha. And usually doesn't even talk about shamatha and vipassana as separate. It's like, it's all one practice. But that's why it's nice to bring up these things, because then we can not make our Buddha too small. Like, oh, yeah, just sit and relax and get really still. And like, oh, this is Buddha. It's like, we don't want to sell ourselves short. But we also don't want to get discouraged and think it's like impossible to do this practice. So something, some middle way to encourage us to keep deepening our investigation of practice, and but not so vast that it's like, well, this is impossible. And all this is near concept. These are just a bunch of stories. See what happens to us. So we still have a few more minutes. If there's no questions, we can start the next chapter. First paragraph, yeah.
Slightly on topic, but I was thinking about the Dogen's returning on the Buddha in the and the one mind that Mindful talks about.
Yeah.
So, but I was remembering a little thing that really stuck in Dogen's classical and that, and I just can't forget it.
Mm-hmm.
He's quoting, he didn't say who, but the patriarch of somebody said, that this very one is nothing bigger than mountains, valleys, that earth, sun, moon, and stars. And I took that as being the phenomenal world, including us, and everything that the discriminating mind can divide everything into, everything possible that could be divided into, is in this mind of chapter 6. I just wondered, I missed your classes on this very mind as Buddha last year, and ever since then I've had this question about that statement.
I think they're on their website too, if you'd like to listen. But yeah, it's very related, because that sounds like a mind-only statement, right? Mountains, rivers, and earth, sun, moon, and stars are mind. So Dogen does do this little, like, his slant on mind only. Is he's constantly trying to get us, he brings up all these traditional teachings and then kind of turns them the other way just so we don't get stuck in the usual view of them. Dogen's constantly doing this. So he turns the mind only thing to so there's like mind and objective world, and we say, no, there's just mind. He turns it so it's like there's just the objective world and there's no subject. Which is the same. It's still non-duality, right? And either way, it's non-duality. But it's kind of like there's just everything. There's nobody to perceive it, and yet here's our experience. So, and to explain that is, I think, harder than to explain this. But because he's a Zen person, he doesn't have to explain it. He's just pointing it out. Like,
I had an intuitive feeling that it was the same, but I didn't know if I was supposed to be the vision.
So I happen to bring that with me. That mind, this very mind, is Buddha. And that part, the kind of the highlight of it. So, you know, what is wondrous clear mind? Mountains, rivers, and earth, sun, moon, and stars. That's Yangshan and Guishan. Mm. And then Dogen says, thus we know that mind is mountains, rivers, and earth. The mind is sun, moon, and stars. What is said here is not more, not less. And then he goes on to say, the mountains, rivers, and earth mind. So, because they're mind, right? So, now we're talking about the mountains, rivers, and earth mind, or like mind manifesting as mountains, rivers, and earth, we could say. But this is classic Dogen. Mountains, rivers, and earth mind are just mountains, rivers, and earth. That's his unique thing, which is very cool, I think. Mountains, rivers, and earth. First we say, mountains, rivers, and earth are mind. So now this mountains, rivers, and earth mind, what is that? Well, it's just mountains, rivers, and earth.
Love it.
Yeah, it's a twister. There are no extra waves or spray. And just mountains, rivers, and earth, nothing extra. And it's a poetic way of saying there's no extra waves or spray. Sun, moon, and stars, mind, is just sun, moon, and stars. There's no extra fog or mist. The coming and going of birth and death, mind, is just the coming and going of birth and death. There's no extra delusion or enlightenment. The walls, tiles, and pebbles, mind, is just the walls, tiles, and pebbles. There's no extra mud or water. The four great elements and the five skandhas, mind, are just the four great elements and five skandhas. There's no extra horse or monkey. The chair and whisk mind is just the chair and whisk. There's no extra bamboo or wood. This being so, mind itself is Buddha does not divide. Mind itself is Buddha. Buddhas do not divide Buddhas. Thus, mind itself is Buddha indicates Buddhas on these different stages of aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana. than saying it's all mind.
Actually, saying it's all mind.
I think it's harder.
Because maybe emotionally we can, even if it's super confusing to say everything is mind and it's jarring, still we have an emotional kind of way of relating to the self.
Yeah.
So if it's closer to the self, it's like, well, it's really confusing, but at least
I think that's very, that's very true.
A hook of that delusion of maybe I'm creating the world, or maybe it's all, maybe it really is all this, you know, it all exists through my perception.
Yeah, kind of like if you had a choice, would you rather have, like, mind and no world, or would you rather have the world and no mind?
Yeah,
from that point of view, I'd rather have the mind, we might think. Because at least then, like, there's something. Yeah, it's maybe, even though it's not actually about the self, from the point of view of a self, that's the one actually hearing all these teachings, that's, I think, very, that's an interesting observation. I think that's so. Whereas to say, and it's, like, Dogen's thing, in a way, it sounds easier because we're like, well, that sounds good, then we don't have to, we don't, suddenly all this stuff is, we got it back again, and it's just, it could be more comfortable in some ways to feel like, well, there really is the world, but then have to, how to really hear that in a way where there is nobody perceiving it, and, you know, how does that come to be? So, there's the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness, and the next chapter is on the marks, the characteristics of, well, the three characteristics of all phenomena. So you can read ahead if you'd like with it on this chapter, and I don't know if people are looking into any of these texts. I mean, because this is complicated, there's no homework, but you get, I think, a broader picture for this if you look at some of these things. And if anybody would like, I am a kind of like digital Dharma collector, so probably all the books on the reading list and many, many, many more articles and texts I have electronically. If you'd like, I can email you various things to read if you have an ebook reader or to read on a computer printout. If you'd like, maybe just give me your email after the class and I can do so. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.